Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything to feel it coming. Do you wake up on your own?
Joining me from all the way from Florida is Andy Milburn. Andy, what is up? Welcome to All Marine Radio.
Been drinking again, Matt?
No, that's the sad part. There's no alcohol involved. Joining me is Andy. Joining me is all this shit will be edited out. Joining me is Andy Milburn. Andy, first of all, welcome to All Marine Radio. How's it going,
Mac? Thank you very much. It's great to be back. I thought I was. I thought I'd been blackballed. Can I say blackballed on this show?
I don't know.
You
we're in a different.
So long.
We're in a different new age relative to communication. So I think I don't know. I think blackballs. I mean, it's historically a way that people were kept out of things, and but no, you weren't blackballed. I mean, it's the ebb and flow of life, Andy. But now you're you made an audiobook, and I'm curious about that. So, what is the how do you make an audiobook?
With great difficulty. So, Mac, you are, and I'm not just saying this because I I'm a pathetic sycophant, but you are a great speaker. Now, if you
– I'm sorry?
You've got – you are a great speaker. Can you hear me? Or you just wanted me to repeat that? Hey, you are.
Kind of no, like, I mean, no it was that – hearing aid commercial. I heard right. I heard you the first time. I just wanted to hear it again.
No, you do. So a couple of things make you an engaging listener, okay? One is the tone of your voice. It's actually – you know, don't take this wrong way, but it's an attractive tone. Okay,
whoa,
it's rich,
whoa, hey.
And you modulate the way you speak. The second is that you, whatever you're talking about, you make it sound interesting. You speak with enthusiasm, and the third part is that you have a minimum of verbal tics. You know, I just use one, you know, right? You know, and it's really rare. It's really rare to find someone who can excise those completely from their conversation. If you watch people on television, professional presenters, they can do that when they talk live. If you notice, they don't ever say but that's really, really rare. So my point here is that even reading it's very difficult to be able to make things to hit the right tone, to modulate your voice correctly, to pronounce everything correctly, and to read at a speed that makes you sound as though you're making conversation. I had no idea how difficult that was, and I consider myself pretty good reader. You know, my voice is okay. You know, hopefully you find it attractive. I had to go through an audition with Audible, not really an audition, but they had to take a soundbite of my voice to make sure that I had the right voice to be what they call a voice actor. But it was an incredibly, incredibly difficult ordeal. Hey, the other thing I didn't realize is that how many people listen to their books or prefer to listen to their books rather than reading. That's maybe something we can get back to. But on the topic of reading, reading your own books. So Audible pays you a pitiful amount. You know, I think it's like $1,500 to read your book, which probably works out at a very, you know, maybe the minimum wage per hour. And so I put myself in my closet in, not for the first time, but in the center of the house, to try and noise proof it, pillows packed around. I got a really expensive microphone and just started reading. I thought, this is going to be really easy. I will do this in a couple of days. It took me months, Mac, because, you know, you get through two or three paragraphs and then your concentration, or at least my concentration, starts to go off a little bit. And if you mispronounce one word or pause too long, then you have to redo it. And that's only the errors that arise from your own mess ups. You know, think about background noise, microphones so sensitive, dogs barking, freaking leaf blowers everywhere. If there was a candidate standing for president who promised to ban leaf blowers, he would definitely get my vote regardless of party. But yeah, anyway, it was tough. I'm glad I did it now, and hopefully, if any of your listeners have got the Audible book, and if they want to give me positive feedback, I'm happy for that. I don't want to hear what a shitty voice I have though.
I hate my voice. I hear my voice. I'm like, man, let's turn that shit off. And I mean, when my kids were little, we'd be riding around and there'd be something on the radio and I'd be on it and they'd be like, Dad, that's you. I'm like, not anymore. Click. We're not listening to that. I've never liked the sound of my voice. And I don't know that I like it even today. And leaf blowers, man, they start at all. Wow. I mean, 7 in the morning, 9 at night. I mean, they go constantly.
Yep. And of course, microphone picks all that up.
Oh,
in the background.
Shit. Yeah.
And so I eventually got through it, recorded it, sent it off to Audible, and then they come back.
How many months?
It took me, you know, I wasn't doing it every day, right. But I was doing, it took me probably 2 to 3 months. And this is, you know, writing, I can write for hours. I need to work up to it, you know, so I will begin. Right. Just by writing an hour at a time and, you know, taking a break at the end of every hour. And then you get more fluid the more you write. But reading out loud, I found so exhausting that the most I ever did in a day was about 2 hours. And that had to be spread out over the day. I know that sounds ridiculous.
No, because really, I think that what most people don't realize is you're not actually reading it. You're performing it.
That's right. That's exactly right. And because you've got to make it sound as though you're not reading it, because that's so boring, right?
It's boring as well, shit. If you read it, and so you're supposed to perform it, which takes a fair amount of intensity, inflection on words, and so that somebody will be drawn into the story, which is, you know, I think it was the fucking reason that you wrote it to begin with, right? So no, I mean, to me, that's 2 hours of that is probably, is probably a lot on a given day, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's good for you to do that. Any type of concentration, and then dialogue. Dialogue.
Yeah.
What do you do? Do you try and imitate the guy's voice or his accent?
Well, that's what they do, and that's what the guy in Viktor Frankl's book does. He sounds like he affects a different voice when it's kind of a it's not an American voice. Hold on, let me play just a snippet, because I'm listening to – I listen to Man's Search for Meaning a couple times a year because, you know, like all great works, I always find that I hear something different, right, every time I listen to it. So
that's right.
This is where I left off Saturday. Oops.
Of me lay the mound of earth which showed exactly how much I had dug. Then he began. You pig, I have been watching you the whole time. I'll teach you to work yet. Wait till you dig dirt with your teeth. You'll die like an animal. In 2 days, I'll finish you off. You've never done a stroke of work in your life. What were you, swine? A businessman? I was past caring. But I had to take his threat of killing me seriously.
See? Now he's not an American. You know, kind of sounds like a Brit. And then he affects his German accent. So how did you do that?
Yeah, so I didn't go overboard on that. For American accents, because most of my audience are going to be American, I thought I'm just going to insult people if I try and imitate, you know, Southern accents.
In a big way.
Yeah, so I didn't. But for Iraqis, for instance, yes, I spoke in a different way, and I can do a fair imitation of the way, you know, a fairly fluent English speaker, but an Iraqi speaks English. So I think the results
Give us a sample.
No.
Come on.
You know, buy my book. No, it's a, you know, no, because it's going to sound very stilted. And now, I mean, I worked at this. So if people don't like listening to this, then they won't get the book. But I do invite you to purchase the Audible
version. It won't sound,
by the way.
It won't sound like the polished Iraqi character that's in your book if you do it right.
No, hey, actually, on this point.
Yes.
You know, if I know you open up your email while you're doing this, and if anyone does, if they don't subscribe to Audible and they want a free copy, by all means, email you, and I will forward you. I've got about 7 promo codes left, so happy to distribute them on the first come, first
service. To go back to a point that you alluded to a little bit ago, the primary way that I consume literature now is through audiobooks.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think I talk to people, the more I realize that's actually becoming the norm.
An interesting trend is if you look at the Wall Street Journal, if you look at the major news distributors now, at the top of all of their columns is a link that you can click on to listen to it.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Yeah. And it didn't used to be as prevalent as it is now. But
now, are they reading their own article, or does Wall Street Journal have a voice actor to do that?
I would imagine they have a voice actor.
Yeah, I would too, because it's you can't just assume that someone is, because someone's a good writer, that they're good at.
Yeah, like you said, all the problems of your closet isn't soundproof, right? The dog's barking. You're not a professional audio person, right? And all those things that happen. And whatnot. So I would think that, they probably don't do it for every article, but I would think they're major pieces that they know are going to, do big numbers. They probably convert to, cause most of the ones I click on all have an audio link, which again is fairly recent. And again, think about it. So I'm driving in my car. I could, I could be listening to music, or I could read the Wall Street Journal while, via my phone as I'm driving to work. When we used to do stuff like that, when you're, out and about, it's another way to consume that content that to me is it's the way to go.
Yeah, since doing the Audible thing, I've actually become a fan of listening to the read word. I didn't know they did that for articles, but I've really started to enjoy listening to Audible books. I don't know, part of it is we all like a good story. And so we're brought up with our parents reading to us. And so part of that, I think, is a hark back to that. It really, it's more absorbing than the usual stuff you listened on the radio.
I think, while you're working out, if you're going to, like I'll take my dogs on a 3-mile walk. I mean, I could listen to music, but, I thought, so I get ready to go the other day. And I'm like, I need to listen to Man's Search for Meaning again. And I get ready to go walk the dogs. And it's like, oh, this is going to be an hour. So, his book's only 4.5 hours. I'll knock that out this week and listen to it again. And I just find it's again, what we used to, consider the domain of music now audiobooks. And like I said, and then the other great is, like, if you have to drive any for any stretch, if you're going to be in the car for a couple hours, I mean, that's to me the best audiobook listening, because you tend not to have anything else in your head. You're driving and you're just listening, and you know, you're alone. I think so. I think the car and dog walking are great examples of audiobook heaven.
Yeah, very, very much so. And I get bored of music after a period of time, and it's nice to be able to focus your mind on something
productive
that isn't too interrupted.
What about, so tell me, how do you, so you're recording and then you send it into them and they review it and they say, yeah, that sucked, you got to do it
again.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you do it chapter by chapter if you're right. Smart. I didn't. I sent in like 5 chapters and they came back and said, hey, this is all shite. You know, you didn't use this settings on your computer on the program, so I had to redo them. But then, yes, they go through chapter by chapter and they'll send parts back to you that you have to re-record. And in my case, there was about 150 of them. So unfortunately, not whole chapters, just sentences here and there, or some cases whole paragraphs. And it might be because you mispronounced something. And here I went back and forth with them, because a lot of my pronunciations still are English, you know, aluminium instead of aluminum, et cetera. And so I won most of those battles. But other things, you just dorked it up. You mispronounced it, or you stuttered for a moment on a particular word, and sometimes you don't even notice. Most of the time I would notice when I'd screwed something up and go back, but evidently I missed 150 ones. And then, you know, after a period of time, it becomes mentally exhausting. You think, oh shit, this is not going to end. I should have got a voice actor. And again, I haven't listened to the final product, but people tell me it sounds natural, which is, you know, really? The best you can hope on these things. Yeah, we'll see.
So would you recommend it? So when I finish writing my book, should I do my own book? Or
yeah, I think you should. I think you should, Mac, because here's, you know, the feedback that I've had from, certainly from friends, and it has been, hey, it means that much more because you're the one who wrote it. So hearing you tell it in your own way, because there are certain things that you want to emphasize or you had in your mind, you want to emphasize a certain way. And only you can really do that, right?
Right.
That's number one. Number two, of course, as I mentioned, you've kind of got that rock star voice quality that people will just fawn over and flock to. And people who know you want to hear it. But yeah, seriously, you'll probably find it much easier than I did. I was surprised. I really was. As I said, I thought I could hold myself up in a closet with a bottle of whiskey and do it all in, you know, about 18 hours straight.
No, it's like anything else. I mean, I've been doing audio stuff for a couple decades, and so I'm good at that. For me, you know, I'm getting ready to shoot my presentation, and so what I did was I narrated a version. Tim Lynch calls me and he says, "Hey man, I got to tell you, I don't want to tell you that it sucked because it's great." He said, "But when you talk about it, the intensity you have when you're doing it is different than you narrating it." And I said,
yeah.
I said, "I know. I heard a part of it." I went, when I do it, and there's, you know, for a live audience, you know, you perform it. When you're here in your room by yourself, you know, and you're doing it, it's going to take you, it's 5 hours. I think I didn't do it justice. So that was an intermediate product to get me to one where I will, you know, with all the video, all the slides, all the images and all that, I will fold that into a performed video. And that's actually the version that I want to have people see. So I'm getting ready to do that. So my education now is in, you know, film and video. How do you do it? How do you light it? How do you, to have the desired effect of that I
light want. It, edit it, And then, as you mentioned, the performance, and that's exactly what it is. So even when you were just reading, even when I was just reading, I found myself using the facial expressions, moving my head, moving my hands, because you have to get into it.
And you can't not do it.
You pictured myself locked up in my closet, with alcohol. So, what a great pastime during COVID, as though I wasn't.
Productive, right? I mean, productive. Yeah. That's what it's been for me, is that I've had to find a way because, I mean, you can't get people together. So how can I do my thing? Well, I've done it virtually. I've done the Air Force has had me do post-traumatic winning virtually for their commander's course in the Pacific. PAC Air has had me there. I've done it with Marine Corps League detachments. I've done it with NROTC units out of University of Arizona a couple weeks ago, did that. And so you've got to find a way. And then, then the video thing. I mean, I built a studio in my garage.
Did you really?
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
Well, I mean, drywall, framing,
soundproofing.
Yeah, the whole thing. And now the fun part. For me now is the creative part, is doing the things that and which now begets a YouTube channel, right? And so this thing has gone outside simply, the DOD, in that, the demand for how do I live a great life after really bad things have happened, really terrible things, devastating things have happened to me. The demand for that is universal. So a YouTube channel going to start. The book is probably 70% done. COVID, for me, it's just been, shifting gears to find a way to get this content to other people. And so, I've worked. Throughout. So, I mean, it's exciting for me, and kind of found the same outlet you found, in the audiobook.
But I love what you're doing too, Mac. I'm not just saying this because you brought me on the show, but because what the presentations that you're giving, I mean, the message that you're giving applies to everyone. It isn't just people who have suffered a tragedy or a major loss. It's about resilience. So it's about overcoming all the crappy things that invariably do happen to us, and not just subsiding into victimhood, but picking yourself up and pushing ahead. And so the stories that you tell to do that are inspirational. And no, this wasn't an advertisement that you induced me or paid me to do, but I think it's tremendous.
We know you've lived through it. The scene in Scent of a Woman when Al Pacino says, "If I were the man I were 10 years ago, I'd take a flamethrower to this place."
Oh yeah.
Right. Yep. It's awesome. And he goes to that hearing for that kid. So I happened to, I played that just goofing off. I was pissed about something and I use that sound effect, but I'm pissed. Like, this seems appropriate right now. And then, then I hit a button.
Wait.
And I hit a button, and you hear this sound effect. For those of you who aren't privy to it, hold on, let me find it. Here it is.
If I were the man I was 5 years ago, I'd take a flamethrower to this place.
So right underneath it, I have the full 5.5-minute scene. And so I must not have had a whole lot going on the show. So I said, have you ever heard the whole scene? Because the whole scene is fantastic. Much like, you want answers. I think I'm entitled to answers. You want it, right? I mean, that is a great.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
Now, as good as that is. Right? That kind of fuck you moment. The whole scene is better. Jack Nicholson and Tom Cruise in that scene. I mean, there's just electricity. Right. And I remember the first time I saw it, it was like, fuck yes and fuck you, man. And I think a lot of us feel that, right? So anyway, I played the whole 5.5 minutes of it. And at the end of it, these are the kind of creative things that happened to me. Al Pacino says, you know, I've been around, you know, and there was a day when I could see, and see I did, boys like this, younger than this, with their arms ripped out, with their legs ripped out. And he says this. He says, but I can tell you, there's no prosthetic for an amputated spirit. And so I watched that, right? And so now that has become the introduction. I say, hi, how are you? My name's Mac, right? I'm here to tell you the truth about what it is to live a great life with trauma. And if you don't like it, I don't give a fuck. So that's kind of my attention getter, right? Because most mental health shit doesn't start like that. And then...
on the same.
So then I put on that video, right? And that there's about a minute of that scene plays. And then I look and I say, what happens if he's wrong? What happens if there is a prosthetic device for a spirit? What happens if today I could teach you how to make one? And then what happens if I could show you how to help somebody regrow that limb? Would you be interested? And they're looking at me like I'm fucking crazy, right? And I say, well, that's where we're going today. And if you think I'm bullshitting, you don't know me. What I'm going to show you about how to do that is as real as me standing here right now. And so so that whole creative thing, now that's the point where I am, is that I've built studios, I've created this infrastructure, and now I'm able to get on with the work of the creative content that, you know, that is to me the most interesting part of my life now is the creative piece. And, you know, it's interesting because I would tell you that one of the common things I have, and you're one of the people with my friends, is that, and you would not know this from looking at them and listening to this, is that they are creative people.
Yeah. Well, to be a good officer in the military, you've got to be creative. Some extent, right? I mean, it isn't just not just as far as problem solving, but also in how you capture the attention of your subordinates. And anyone who says, I think we talked about this before, that leadership is not in part an act, has never had to lead over a sustained period of time. Of course, you have to act at times, and knowing when to and when not is it exercises your creativity. I mean, if you work for someone who is not at all creative, it becomes very apparent, and they're usually shitty leaders. So, yeah, there absolutely is.
The inductive thought process of, you know, the deductive, you know, A plus B equals C, right?
Yeah.
Right? But the inductive process is, right, A plus – you know, X equals, you know, question mark. So when you work for those, and that's most of my friends are like that, and they will look at a situation and they begin to question the premises of, you know, the road that we're going down, which to me is the creative process. And then out of that comes this, you know, well, who said we had to do it like that? All right. Well, they're not here anymore. All right, so we're going to knock that wall out. We're going to build a bridge there, which opens up all these different things because we're not going down that road anymore. Oh, man. Holy shit. So, no, I find it very interesting. I want to talk about some current
events. It is very interesting.
No, yeah, it's my favorite thing. I mean, the whole creative process now and listening to people. And mostly, my stuff revolves around getting people to see that, you know, that the dark places that we go are normal in life. And if you want to get through those things, these are the things you have to do. Yeah. And if you won't do these things and you won't live, if you won't embrace self-discipline in your life after you go through difficult times, if you want to be a drunk, right? If you want to be a recreational drug user, if you don't want to stay physically fit, which is good for your brain, if you don't want to handle your money well, then you are going to create a toxic cocktail that you're going to be swimming in, and it's not going to be a pleasant situation. But if you will embrace those things, if you will follow Admiral Stockdale's lead and the guys who came out of the Hanoi Hilton, that they did under much more rigorous conditions, then you can live not only a good life, you can live a fantastic life, right? But it's not going to come at no cost to you. But if you're willing to go there, and that's the most exciting. I mean, clearly, I live the coolest life of anybody I know, because those are my days. It'll happen to me today. I promise you. I don't know what's going to happen, but at some point today, somebody will reach out. But again, I've done all the construction. I've done all this, and now I'm doing the creative part, which I love. I want to ask you about some current events.
Yeah, absolutely.
First of all, have you seen the movie, the documentary, The Social Dilemma?
No, I have not. All right. Is that a deal breaker?
No. It's just interesting, made. It's on Netflix. It's watch it. You're traveling, so watch it if you have Netflix. But it's about social media and the engineers and how they engineer and the dopamine and the physiology of the brain and what they try to do and ultimately where it goes. And so one of the interesting things is they ask in the movie, so where does this take us?
Yeah.
And the response is civil war. That you have such polarized –
So with reference to the upcoming elections, right?
Well, and beyond, is that what you have is that your news feed is a unique news feed on the planet based on your desires,
your makeup, right. your background.
That algorithm takes your data and forms – you think everybody's seeing this. You think this is the common operating picture. But what you don't know is – this is you going down, you know, your own rabbit hole.
Yeah.
And so it's absolutely
simply
clear
reinforcing to you. Your beliefs, building on them, even building on your fears, which is an element of advertising.
Right.
Yeah.
So I would tell you that you should watch it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm curious. Like all of us, you watch politics and things like that. What do you think about the tone and tenor of, you know, what's going on in the country?
Yeah, I'm actually really concerned, Mac. And before I say that this is probably unprecedented, I recognize the alternate argument is just that it's unprecedented in our lifetimes, the degree of polarization. And devil's advocate would say, well, you know, back in, for instance, 1968, there was an extreme polarization between, for instance, the portion of the country, the so-called silent majority, who perhaps, you know, supported the war and regard themselves as being patriots. And on the other side, the emergent civil rights / anti-war movement those who opposed everything about the establishment at the time. But I tell you what, back to our time, I tell you, this is something that concerns me, Mac, is as long as I can remember while wearing uniform, I can remember not that many political discussions. Most military officers and certainly Marines, when they're bullshitting, they having discussions. So it doesn't turn to politics that often. It's often about sports or something else. But I will say this, that when there were political discussions, and of course, as you get near the elections, they become they become more common. There was generally a feeling of friendly kind of debate, even among opposing views. But that, even in our profession, seems to have gone. You know, if you think about, do you remember? It was just a very recent example, Mattis's article in The Atlantic, right? You know, he expressed a view about the, you know, the president, or at least his policies, blah, blah, blah. And then there was a Marine colonel, right?
Jim Bathurst.
Yeah, who wrote a vitriolic.
Oh, man.
Vitriolic. Attack on him, not on what Mattis was saying, but on Mattis the person,
and Bathurst's perception that he has become a political person. You know, how dare you do right? I mean, that was the tone and tenor.
And so I'll tell you what, that was not an anomaly. Is what I'm getting to. That was not an anomaly. The arguments, even among those in uniform, have become increasingly shrill and polarizing to an extent that I cannot remember before. Now, given, let's face it, with the most military officers are reflexively right-wing. Right of center. Right. I mean, right-wing. Right. So there's often not that much scope for disagreement. But that, you know, that stance maybe has not changed as far as political views right of center, but the kind of the block that is pro the current president and anti current president has become very much polarized. And so getting back to Bathurst's open letter, I think he called it, I read that and it just saddened me. You know, I just thought, is this where we've become? And you may think that this sounds very hokey, but you know, as Marines, you often think, hey, listen, we may not even like each other, but there has to be some common ground of respect. And that was clearly not there at all. You know, when you're calling some guy who, after all, has served this country for years, regardless of whether you agree with him or not, you're referring to him publicly as scum. It's just, you know, it disappointed me. You know, I just felt it saying, why can't you write, if you're going to write an open letter, why not criticize Mattis's political argument? Criticize his argument, criticize his politics by all means, but don't go after the guy himself. And if you do go after the guy himself, do it in a direct, you know, letter to him or email to him without CCing the world. It just seemed, I know I'm picking out one example, but that seemed to me representative of a rift that I find disturbing. The other part,
but let me ask you. So that's though the tone and tenor of the world now, right?
Very much so.
I mean, you can't have, you know, everybody says we need to have a conversation about race. You can't have one.
No.
I mean,
because, about anything.
Right. Because the first thing that if I don't like what you're saying, and this is to me what I find interesting, Andy, is growing up as a kid, you know, in the 60s and the 70s, one of the things I heard is like, look, I don't like what you're, you know, I don't like your point of view, but I will defend your right to the death for you to say that.
To say it. Yeah.
Now what you hear is, yeah, he doesn't have a right to say that.
That's exactly
and
right.
I have a right to prevent him from saying that. And and you see that. And to me, that's a bit astounding. And then to make matters worse, where we are politically, you don't see universal condemnation about things, the rioting in Portland, right?
Yeah.
When the Speaker of the House, and I'll pick on her, when she never says this is wrong and has to stop, you know, you're looking at it going, are we there politically that we won't stand up for, I think, would have been universal ideals, and that rioting is now just another political event? You're like, that's not good, man. And so to me, but here's my question for you. So what turns it around?
Yeah, I'm pausing because certainly not the outcome of an election, whoever wins, I don't see those divisions going away. And I think, you know, I have to see this movie, The Social Dilemma, because, yes, a lot of this, I think, has been accentuated by how we receive our news in kind of an echo chamber. And there are, I brought up 1968 as a comparison or a contrast, but back then, you know, there were three, four main news channels. So everyone got their news from the same source. They may have interpreted it differently or had different views about it, but at least the news they got was the same news, for better or for worse, however objective. Does that make sense? Whereas now, even if you go to mainstream media, the channels are aligned with a particular political viewpoint.
Well, with the narrative, and then the news is filtered to fit the narrative. And that's to me, in terms of the media, what you see today is it's the narrative that's important. And then even the news reporting, which is supposedly this sacred cow of journalism the reporters, those people, they just report facts and you make up your mind. That's not the way it's done anymore. Right.
Yeah.
And that's to me has been a huge change. And so I don't see. And it was that's why this documentary, right, was interesting to me. How does this change in the nation? And I, for the life of me, I don't understand why they've gone unregulated as they have. I thought one of them made a good point in the documentary. You know, when you advertisers during cartoon hour on Saturday morning or the hours at young. I mean, that was pretty well regulated. There's none of that on the internet.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
there's
nothing.
There's none of that. They do what they'll advertise what they want. And so how does these companies, which are some of now the wealthiest companies that have ever existed on this planet, how have they just gone unregulated? And to the effect and ultimately, you know, the most probably disturbing point in the documentary is this. So what's most at risk? And so you see the and there are people that were like, one guy's an ethicist at Google. One guy invented the like button on Facebook. One guy was the guy who was the what do they call that? He developed the business model. So Facebook had this thing. Oh, he was the monetizing, director of monetization. So we have this thing. How do we make it make money though? And so he was the one that brought in the advertising model as the way to monetize this thing. So there are those people and you hear them say that. And then they say, well, what's the greatest risk is democracy, because it is the open forum that other forms of government will prey on. And it allows this open exchange, and this open exchange is being exploited by companies for money. And you're just going, whoa.
I'm not sure it's democracy itself, right? But it's how democracy functions. So I suppose, yes, I'm saying the same thing.
Right.
And that's a really interesting viewpoint. So if you are seriously undermining people's perspective by presenting them with a view of the world that just doesn't reflect reality, but reflects their own personal opinions, and you're playing on their fears.
For money, which is
then you are. Yes, I suppose. Yes, it's very interesting. You are undermining democracy. You're not undermining democracy by disenfranchising people. You're undermining it by altering their perspective of the issues in the world. That's a really interesting.
I think it's fascinating. And one of the other pieces of it is, I've told the story before, but I had a senator that I interviewed, and he said, the lubricant of democracy is compromise. The only thing that happens now, if you compromise with the other party on a major issue, is you will guarantee yourself as an incumbent a challenger in the primary, and you'll be called a sellout.
Yeah.
And so if you look at the bell curve, the vast majority of members of Congress would be moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats. That forms the long axis of the bell curve. Well, if you can't cross party lines, then and you put an artificial line down the center of that, in order to pass legislation, where do both sides of that line need to go? They need to go to the fringes. And those fringes are people like AOC. And so they now get an amplified voice because the center doesn't control anymore.
Yeah.
And it's this polarization, this political polarization, you know, that, you know, Dianne Feinstein is going to get run out of her job as the, you know, and I don't, I think my own opinion is Dianne Feinstein's finest days as an American senator are behind her. She's 87 years old. Okay. And so being the ranking minority member on the Senate Judiciary Committee might be beyond her scope at her age. Now, she, at the end of the hearing for Judge Amy Coney Barrett, complimented Senator Graham on the way he ran the proceedings, you know, allowing them to vent their spleen, blah, blah, blah. And at the end of it, she gave him a hug, you know, after the whole thing was over.
Yeah.
She was excoriated for that.
Yeah.
Taken to task.
It's,
Chuck Schumer called her in and had a serious discussion with her.
Isn't that ridiculous?
Right. And just like, and are we really there?
She's part of the, you know, the old guard that believed in doing that. McCain was another, you know, with the death of McCain, I think we lost a kind of a I mean, you know, everyone knows that McCain was very outspoken and had very, you know, entrenched views. But on the other hand, he had a lot of friends who were across the aisle, Democrats. And, you know, even President Obama tells the story that, you know, McCain and he would, you know, whatever, have a over a beer in the evenings, would talk through issues that they had, and they didn't agree with one another. But it was, you know, it never became as vitriolic. But that viewpoint of, you know, absolutely, I disagree with you, I think what you're going to do is harm the country. Nevertheless, your view and your stance and the fact that you have a platform for that is part of this great, you know, messy experiment that we call democracy. And it's, you know, it's important that you be allowed that.
Well, and again, so, you know, the great abolish the police movement, that will spend itself. And there will be people that die unnecessarily, but that will spend itself. And then in its wake will come law and order candidates, right, who then get elected, who restore some kind of equilibrium when the system gets out of whack. Because when you call 911, you expect a police officer to show up, and that's why we band together in communities for our mutual protection. That's one of the most basic things that we do. And so it is the – and I also have a – you know, our grandparents constantly asked us, hey, are you saving your money? And you're like, oh, grandma, like, I got a credit card. It's got room on it. I'm good, right? Well, then something like COVID happens, and that room on that credit card doesn't last very long. And you wind up living through something that our grandparents lived through, the Depression and the Dust Bowl, for probably 10 years of their lives. They lived through it. And so the things that were, you know, that were embedded in their head, were emblazed in their brain tissue because they saw, you know, their either themselves or somebody else be evicted and have to move and their lives completely turned upside down by this economic event in the United States, taught them lifelong lessons about what it is to be financially secure. Well, we've never lived through those times. And so, yeah, I've got a credit card. Well, all of a sudden, when you go through the same thing, when you're laying in bed looking at the ceiling wondering, I have no idea how I'm going to do this for another month. I mean, I'm already behind my, you know, mortgage 2 months. I don't see any light at the end of the tunnel. I can't, I'm looking for jobs. I can't find one, right? I'm driving for Uber and Lyft and nobody's going anywhere. I mean, that has taught everybody, you know, lessons, and maybe the law and order lesson is another one that we'll learn. So, no, I mean, it's,
yeah, COVID has exposed some of the weaker underpinnings of our society. You know, by that, I mean that they you know, we don't, I mean, and they, so tired of people throwing around the term socialist. You know, socialism means nationalized industries. It doesn't necessarily mean healthcare for all. It doesn't, it, you know, I mean, it's socialism is a whole package. People commonly misunderstand it. But my point being, you know, richest country in the world, you know, one of the questions is really central questions. I'm not falling hard down on either side. This isn't a political statement. One of the central questions is, what do you do for your least capable members, the least capable, some would say least deserving, but least capable members of your society? Should there not be a safety net for those people? Isn't that the measure of a society to some extent? How do you do that and still preserve some of those things that we hold central to our beliefs as Americans?
Well, such no, as, I mean, there you know, absolutely should be not only a safety net, but a helping hand up.
That's right.
And so to me, one of the discussions that we have to have is, you know, look, you know, the Civil Rights Act got passed over 50 years. We're still unsuccessful in large inner city areas of our major metropolitan areas. So how do we reimagine transitioning people out of that? What does that take? Because the trillions of dollars that we've flushed down that hole haven't made the difference that we need it to. So what are the things that we have to do? You know, what are the things that we have to do to change that, you know, once and forever? And how do we rethink that? And see, to me, it's like we're not having that conversation. It's like
we're not at all, because because if you continuously bang the drum and say we are the greatest nation on earth, you cease to learn from other people. So we as a country will not learn from the way, for instance, Taiwan or South Korea handled the pandemic. I'm not talking about China. I'm not talking about going there. But, you know, the better ways that were done. We will not learn from, and this is going to make some people shudder, I know, but the European countries who are emerging from this with a lower level of unemployment. You know, it's the COVID has had much of a less of an impact on their society because instead of handing out stimulus checks to everyone, which get frittered away, they have subsidized employers but made it illegal to fire people in a number of cases. So in other words, people have kept their jobs. The employers are subsidized. But people don't get turfed down the street with no prospects and then get $1,200 and told, hey, there's your stimulus check, which, as I said, gets a brief boost to the economy, but there's no sustainment. So again, you know, this isn't me just blabbing away. You can look at the numbers. You can look at unemployment rates in Western Europe, countries that were hit per capita equally as bad as the United States. Why are unemployment rates lower? Why is the impact on their particular economy on their economies not as severe? Wrong terminology. Impact on their society. Arguably not as severe. That level of desperation is not there. And again, I think it gets back to, we can still be the foremost capitalist nation in the world and believe in all the things that we can do, but still take care of our least, you know, our least capable members.
Well, let me tell you, in my opinion, and I used to laugh because people would say, are you a conservative Democrat or a liberal Republican? And I'd say, I don't know. You tell me.
Yeah,
you know, here's what I believe. But I believe that
that's a good.
If you're that great of a country, and the American dream isn't real, that people have lost faith in that, and I think to a great extent with the erosion of the middle class jobs, that's where people used to seek to get to. Right? I'm going to get a good job. I'm going to have a home. My kids are going to go to school. The American dream, and that was the bedrock of the stability of the nation. Well, in the name of quote unquote free trade, and my whipping boy for this is Orrin Hatch, right? This extremely conservative senator I see on TV saying, well, you know, these tariffs with China concern me because I believe in free trade. Well, Senator, if you think what's going on between the United States and China is free trade, the good news is your head is so far up your ass. you'll be able to shortly, you'll be able to peek out of your mouth, okay? Because that's how far, right, the rectal cranial event is has penetrated. I mean, come on, you know. And so yeah. And so by delivering all those jobs to other nations, we've eroded, you know, a stepping stone of the American dream. Now, did we do that just to keep stay elected and so that I could buy my soccer ball for $5.99 instead of $7.99? Because we all know that makes my quality of life better. But, I mean, to me, and those are the discussions that we can't have because we can't even sit down at the same table. I've got an email question for you. Mac, what is Andy doing these days? He's obviously a writer and now an orator. What is he doing? Is he just sitting around getting drunk
in Florida?
I love that. What are you doing?
Well, first, in answer to your question, yes, but don't belittle that. That takes some time and effort. Unfortunately, I'm not a professional writer in the sense I can earn a living from it. But I am working for JSAL, Joint Special Operations University. I do teaching still overseas. In fact, I'm heading out to Somalia for Thanksgiving. A great place to spend Thanksgiving.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving.
First half of December, teaching their Dinab light infantry dudes who come as close as to what the Somali army has to special forces, teaching them the planning techniques, you know, the MMDP or Marine Corps planning process. We call it the special operations planning course because you've got to throw special operations in there to get people to attend the course. So I do that. And then I'm also doing some work supporting, the exercises for Naval Special Warfare Command, for instance. I'm leaving this afternoon. In fact, I'm going to have to go in a couple of minutes, Mac, because I'm catching a flight to your part of the world, or at least to San Diego, to do that for the next couple of weeks. And then I go from there to Somalia. So it's good. You know, I'm not putting on a suit going to work every day, which I find just the prospect of that, I find anathema. But I'm doing stuff that doesn't change the world, but it allows me at least to have some sense of purpose, which I think is all important. And equally important, it allows me to mix with the sort of people that I did when I wore the uniform. And that's, you know, to me, that's it. Those two things are what kept me in uniform, right? Sense of purpose and the camaraderie of those around you.
Right.
Thanks for asking.
Here's another one. Hi, Mac and Andy. Great to hear you both. Just gave a copy of the book to my brother as a birthday gift and have read mine twice. Thanks as always, and Semper Fi, Nancy. Nancy suffers from multiple sclerosis, and she's a chaplain in Western Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Hey, Nancy, I sent you a message. I am on Facebook asking for your address so I can send you a signed copy. So please.
Yeah, so you might want to answer, Nancy, all that chaplain stuff. Come on.
But great to hear from you, Nancy.
All right. One more. Mac, where do we find Andy's Audible book? On Audible? Is that the only platform that carries it right now?
No, if you go to Amazon and then you put in When the Tempest Gathers, the name of the book, or my name, it'll give you three options. You can get it hardback or on Kindle or on Audible.
Whoa.
Hey, by the way, guys, if you do that, please pause for a moment to give the book a star rating on Amazon. One of the first reviews I had, Mac, it wasn't a review. It was a one star rating from a dude who, unfortunately, I had to relieve in Mosul. The guy was, I mean, a total dirtbag. Hate to say that about anyone, but aside from being a physically a coward, he was a liar and a thief, which together don't really make, you know, good. But anyway, so he gave me a one star rating, and that poor mate. And those things apparently are important. You know, I didn't realize that, but there's some Amazon algorithm that's linked to the number of star ratings you get. I know half your listeners are going to give me a one-star rating now, but please don't. So if you find yourself on the site, it won't take a second. You don't even have to write a review. Just give me a star rating, which would be, yeah, awesome.
Yeah,
that was – hey, on that point, Mac, and I'm going to have to go in a moment, but, you know, the next time I come on, I'll tell you what would be a good topic of discussion you know, I talked about relieving someone. Unfortunately, you know, it's only fortunate people who've been in command and haven't had to relieve someone. And the commandant just sent out a, I guess it was a memo, policy memo. Did you hear about this?
Yeah.
Saying no more soft release, right? So when you relieve someone, they have to get an adverse fitness report. We've all seen people who've kind of been shunted from one place to another. Mac, I mean, not you, but they've not done well in a number of billets. So I understand where he's coming from. Soft reliefs can be the bane of everyone's view of their profession, because you get these lemons being shuttled around. But I would argue that passing a policy or directing people never to do something gets back to your point about creativity. You take away one aspect, one tool in leadership, and there may be cases where soft reliefs are the right thing to do. I'm not, you know.
Well, let me just tell you, I think there's a, and I will let you go because I know you got to go. But you know, I'm not sure at what rank you become a politician, on the officer side or on the enlisted side. But I think there is a disease in the uniformed services, and that is political speak. It's, you know, and soft relief is, you know, is may, in my opinion, mostly done for political reasons. If somebody can't do it, there's a way that you're supposed to show them the door. And
misplaced compassion.
Right. I mean, and there's a time and a place for compassion. There's also not a time and a place for compassion.
That's right.
And to me,
the balance between empathy, because all leaders have to have empathy. To be a good leader, you have to. And that makes relieving someone one of the most painful things you have to do, along with, you know, having to bury one of your Marines or inform his parents. And but it's a fascinating topic. I mean, you could spend spend an hour on this topic about.
Let me tell you, man. I saw. I was the transporter of the relieved commanders and their sergeant majors, if that guy went to, from Iraq to CONUS for J.N. Mattis. And he was not afraid to do that.
No.
Right. And to me, I took on a whole different understanding watching him, because what he showed everybody was he would not tolerate. If you didn't love your Marines, if you didn't care about them, if they lived in shit, if they lived in filth, if the chow halls, all, if you weren't loving them, he had no problem showing you the door. And the effect that had on everybody else, and so you saw the function of relieving people.
Yeah. Okay, I mean, it's a necessity at times.
You have to.
But it's not always – so the cases you're talking about, and I can think of cases that I haven't lost a minute's sleep about because of the sort of leader that you talked about that simply doesn't care. But there have been other cases where I really –
Well, see, I would agree. Not that they don't care, that they're failing. And so to me, they could be a well-intentioned human being and they're failing, right? And so it's not like the guy who you described who gave you the one-star interview, right? It's not that guy. It's somebody who's a good – he's a nice guy. He just can't do this. And
that's
you have to be up, you know, to essentially ending that person's career. You have to be up to that, and you can't be afraid of it. But to me, we got so many politicians, right? We got so many politicians. Hey, we're not changing the standard at IOC, but you don't have to pass all 9 hikes anymore. You just got to pass 3 of them. What?
Yeah.
Who said that?
But those, I agree with you, but those are two different issues. I think,
no, in my opinion, they're the same political bullshit. It's the same political speak. It's not willing to stand up and say, no, we are going to change the standards at IRC, and I'm going to change them, and here's why.
That is one failing, but another two is just the innate human desire to avoid intra-person unpleasantness.
Oh my God! And you're in the Marine Corps, and you're a leader. Like, what fucking planet are you on? Right? Right? Who the fuck are you? Right? If they're that bad, if you're gonna do it, then do it.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. But it's, yeah. Anyway, it's a great topic. And, you know, on the discussions of relief, do you make those reasons public? Or do you just use that tawdry phrase, loss of trust and confidence, and think that the word won't get out, or
make it public, do you mean release it in a press conference? Like, I relieved Andy Milburn for his excessive alcoholism.
Explain to everyone why it was done. I think there's value in that.
Who's everyone? The command or
the public? The command and peers? Yes, certainly.
Yeah, I think so.
I think that's absolutely necessary.
Well, so I think your fellow commanders and whatnot, you know, I think they certainly should be told why.
Yeah.
And to me, that's how no attrition, no morale, that's how that – because becomes a substantive statement in that, look, you know, we do have attrition. And I saw, you know, the fruits of General Mattis's no bullshit attitude with his specifically regimental commanders and battalion commanders and separate battalion commanders. I mean, he looked at them, and if you weren't meeting the mark, man, you knew that he would smoke your ass. And what happened was all the average performers – performed at an above average level. And that's why the 1st Marine Division in 2004, I thought, performed exceptionally throughout all the different things that happened in that year. And a lot of it was his intimidation at a high level to commanders, saying that, you know, look, what you think is good enough isn't good enough. So it better be very good.
And something has to be, yes, so you're right. Inspiration alone will not affect the marginal.
And you know what? Because a guy like Joe Dunford is this incredible leader, inspires a great number of people. But to me, as you go higher in rank and the number who you influence, they don't always move by love. But I will tell you, a lot of them move because of fear.
Yeah.
And I don't. I wish that love was enough to move a lot of people. A lot of times it's not. And I would have never told you this because it's not essentially what I would have said was my style, but
you lead by fear, Mac. Certainly. Oh, I remember very much. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I think I had, even in those critiques we do, I mean, they were two different critiques even in the early 90s at IOC. We critiqued the decision-making and that was the intellectual piece of it. And then it went prick city. It was, okay, let's talk about execution. How did we do? Why the fuck did you not cross the line of departure on time? Why were you not? And then it became asshole city. It's like, whoa, these guys are like all cool and cerebral. And then they just turned into asshole pricks.
Yeah.
I think because you have to have both.
Yeah, and you've got to. Right? You do. You've got to know when to. And that gets back to regardless of your personal styles or personality, at times leadership has to be an act. And an act may simply mean you need to bolster yourself to do things that you find difficult to do. You are not within your comfort zone. So I agree with all of that. Hey, Mac, it's been a great pleasure. I've got to rush for my flight to get out to San Diego.
Well,
listeners.
If you have a free evening, shoot me a text and we'll go have dinner in Oceanside.
Awesome. San
Clemente. We'll meet halfway.
Yeah, that sounds great, Mac.
All right, bud.
I'd love to. All the best.
Yeah, and congratulations on the audiobook. Well done.
Thank you.
Yep.
Frickin' buy it.
There you go. That is Andy Milburn here on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio. Here's an email. The let's see. I find it interesting the stories you tell about being able to watch General Mattis from such a unique vantage point. I would have loved that. Trust me, it did not. It did not lack for interesting content on a daily basis. It was pretty interesting, and like I said, I mean, my style, I would have told you, is, you know, was more personal. But I learned from I think from him, you know, the power of being a relentless, uncompromising leader, especially as you go up and you lose the ability on a daily basis to monitor and influence. So you don't have that as many personal contacts with somebody because your kingdom is much more vast, and so your time is much more spread out. So what do they have to know? Well, it has to be written in stone that these things will get you fired, and there can be no compromise in that, and that, you know, that would not be a pleasant event. And so, to me, wasn't always pleasant. But again, what was communicated? These are the things I expect, and if you want to go away, go ahead and screw one of them up, and I will make you go away with certainty. With certainty. So, that'll do it. If you're just tuning in, hour one, talk about the World Series a little bit, but we talk about the documentary, The Social Dilemma. A number of people have asked me, had I watched it? I wound up watching it Friday night, and then watched it again with my daughters last night. They were sitting there going, "Whoa, I'm not going to look at my phone the same way." I'm like, "I know." Somebody in the documentary calls it an electronic pacifier. Interesting. Anyway, I would without a doubt tell you to watch it, and I'd be curious to hear what you think about it. So you'll hear about that. You'll hear about the World Series a little bit, and then we touch on the news. My argument for why do we need NPR? Why do we need federal funding for a radio station? Why do we need to fund Stars and Stripes? I don't get it. I don't understand. So, and then we check the news real quick. And I demonstrate why I don't think Stars and Stripes is a good idea. So anyway, you have that to look forward to. So on a Monday, have a great day. And the first thing you ought to do, right, my lesson from watching The Social Dilemma is turn off all the notifications on your phone. Why? Why? Because that phone is a device that you use. It doesn't use you. And for most people, that phone uses you. And the first step to uncoupling it, yourself from it, is shut off all the notification. It doesn't summon you for anything. You'll go to it when you want it. The next thing is change your search engine to something that doesn't track anything. Anything. There's a search engine called Quant. Quant. And doesn't save any of your browsing history. Right? So, there's a few of them out there. So, check them out. Anyway, on a Monday. Most importantly, don't be afraid to change somebody's life. I saw articles over the weekend about opioid addiction, suicide, isolation, suicide. So don't be afraid to stick your hand out and help somebody. Hey, man, can I talk to you? and then touch their lives. So on that note, have a great Monday. All Marine Radio, out.